Thanks a lot for giving me this opportunity to present Gravity. I'm not the PI of that instrument. The PI is Frank Eisenhower. He would have loved to be here. He couldn't be here. And he asked me to just replace him. But before I start, let me come to a very low gravity environment. I just can report that, at least the German news reported that that thing on the comet has safely landed 3 minutes ago, or the message arrived on Earth that it has landed. That's a selfie, I suppose, yeah. Okay, let me turn to SAGE A*. And we have seen the tremendous resolution you can get in the radio regime. In this plot, I show as a function, as frequency, the possible resolution you can get. And you can see, of course, it's unbeatable if you go to VLBI. However, there's also, in the optical regime, you get quite good resolution. And there's this trick that you can do optical interferometry, which pushes you down a factor 10 or so. And you can see it's a sweet spot just before the extinction screen hits in. And at the same time, you also observe stars at those wavelengths. So this very good probes for gravitational forces as opposed to gas measurement. Here's our version of the orbit of S2. You can see that our latest data point is from 2013. This is because this year our imager was taken from the telescope. But we've continued, of course, monitoring, at least in the spectroscopy domain. And you can see the radial velocity curve. The red points are measurements from the Keck telescope, which Andrea has provided. And if you do a combined fit here, that's the numbers which I give from the 2009 paper. You can see there's a distance uncertainty, which is still rather large in the systematic errors. This has to do with the reference frame, which Andrea was also alluding to. But once you take that out, the mass of the black hole is rather well determined to 1.5%. That's better than you know your own mass, I would think. And so in 2009, we had these constraints on mass and distance. Here's from our 2013 data set. That's the updated constraint. So you can see it's worthwhile to continue, although, of course, the progress is gradual. We cannot measure the periastron shift of the orbit yet. You can calculate that it should advance by roughly 0.2 degrees per revolution. That is 16 years. And our measurement error is of that same order, and that's why we cannot see that yet. However, if you ask what will happen in the future, I think we will have that term detected safely by 2019. The reason is that precession does not happen as you think if in an undergrad textbook that you sort of have the ellipse rotating constantly, but the ellipse is rather ticking like a mark on your clock. It's moving at each pericenter passage, and that is illustrated here for a short period orbit with large eccentricity in the paper from Angelil and Zaha. You can see that the angle essentially swaps over at pericenter and is rather constant otherwise. Translated to our measurements, you can see here predictions how well you can determine relativistic parameters. These are the deviations. You simulate a relativistic orbit and you ask the question, how well does a Keplerian orbit fit and how well does a relativistic orbit fit and what's the difference between the two. And as soon as that number is larger than your measurement accuracy, you can pick it up and you can see the numbers here are small on the order of a few hundred microarcseconds by 2019 or 20, but that's the level of accuracy we can actually reach. As Andrea also showed, the gravitational redshift is well within reach. You can see the same exercise here for the radial velocity. Our typical measurement errors on the order of 25 kilometers per second. And you can see that curve is up by 60 or so for over a year. So if you sample that nicely, it's a no-brainer to get that. Just make sure that the instrument is at the telescope and works. But imagine you would be allowed to zoom in further. Here I took a few of the stars and just made the orbit smaller. You can actually expect that we should see in the central millihundred arc seconds on the order of 2 to 10 stars. You know that from extrapolating the density profile and also the luminosity function. So these stars should have magnitudes between 17 and 19, and they would orbit in a year. And the precession would be a few degrees per year, the relativistic precession. So that's a wonderful PhD thesis, because you can sort of, in the first year, you detect your star. In the second year, you notice that it rotates. In the third year, you confirm and write up. So it's a nice layout program here. But of course, there's more people who want to do that. And the way how we think we can zoom in further is interferometry. And we have an instrument which is being built at our institute, at the Max Planck Institute. It's called Gravity. We didn't know any better name for it. It's a four-telescope beam combiner for the VLTR. And you can see that we want to combine the light of the 4 8-meter telescopes to synthesize a 120-meter telescope with that optical telescope. That's a complicated machine. The first big difference to all what you're doing is we cannot record our electric fields. We only have intensities, and we have to do the interference online. So we have to do that the moment we are at the telescope, and that's why you have these delay line tunnels. You have to delay the light by sufficient amounts so that you can actually coherently overlap that. But that's not the only complication. So we want to do that for four telescopes, giving you us six baselines. That means you have to have four of those delay lines, which you have to control in real time. You also need adaptive optics because we are a ground-based telescope, so we need to correct to the diffraction limit before, which in turn means that you have to quadruple the effort one has already in place so far, namely infrared wavefront sensing here. We could also have four laser stars, but that would be even more technical trouble. You want to have a dual feed facility because you don't want to measure in absolute terms. You want to measure between a reference star and your source of interest. So you actually have to have two beam combiners because you can only interfere the light of each star with itself, of course. And you need to do not only adaptive optics, but you also need to control the zeroth order of the waves, that is the fringe delay. And you have to do fringe tracking. Currently, without fringe tracking, interferometry is limited to exposure times of milliseconds. That's simply the coherence time of the atmosphere at these wavelengths. But with that, then we can go to arbitrary large integrations, and we currently design our system that we can run up to 300 seconds, so 5 minutes. At the heart of our instrument is a beam combiner that's actually a very neat piece. It has more or less the size of this little pocket here. It's a piece of glass, and you have in wave channels. You can see on the left side that there's four telescopes which are being fed in. And these wave channels have a few hundred micron diameter, so you have to imagine the light from the 8-meter telescope is concentrated into these little channels, and then you get, it doesn't look quite like Waterloo Central Station, but like a more reasonable Central Station. You have all possible combinations of telescopes, and then you get these outputs. And if you look at the bottom part of this slide, you can see how the beam combination is done. You actually split up the light coming from two telescopes, and you sample the fringe at four phase angles. And what that gives you is sort of a perfect sampling of a fringe. And the result from that is that you measure complex visibilities. So we are not only limited to closure phases, we are really measuring the phases and the amplitudes, the complex visibilities fully. Here you can see one of these beam combiners in action. You also can see that there's apparently two of these rows of intensity patterns. That's because we split the polarization, so you have polarization information here. And you can see the fringes, they are flickering. That's just the vibrations you have in the laboratory, which are, of course, on the micron level, our wavelength. You can also spectrally disperse the fringes. That's then what gives you a bit more UV coverage, and that's, of course, what we also want to do. But that comes, of course, at the cost of sensitivity. So what we want to do is we want to do phased reference imaging and astrometry. And the principle is rather simple. So you have that reference source here marked by the red star and the one in yellow, usually it's the fainter object, that's the Sag A star at the galactic center. And you just want to know the angle between those two sources very precisely. So there's an angle alpha and beta. The telescopes are separated by a baseline, and you measure OPD. You can then measure that quantity very precisely due to the fringe pattern. That's the basic idea. And the formula is extremely simple. I give that here. That's the formula you have to apply. However, if you think about the next order, that is what gives you your errors. The formula looks like that. And there's plenty of terms in here. All of these are numbers and quantities which you can measure, respectively, which you have to control. And that's why it's such a horrible machine. For example, you have to control the internal optical paths to nanometer level. You have to make sure that your pupil is stable to within below a millimeter, and there's many things. That's what makes the business so hard. The principle is very easy. The implementation is rather difficult. Nevertheless, if we do end-to-end simulations, you can convince yourself that you can do it. Here is, for example, the point spread function. If you take four telescopes, you can integrate on parallel roughly 9 hours on Sag A star. Using the K-band information. That's a reasonable point spread function, which you can hope that gives you an image. Here's a simulated image, and then if you just apply a simple clean algorithm, you get something like that. But of course, there are smarter ideas how to do that. Frédéric Vincent, who was working in the Meudon group, he has simulated how well the astrometry can be recovered from these images, and you can see the numbers here. These are microarc seconds, so we can measure things to the precision of on the order of 10 microarc seconds. It depends on the complexity of the field you reconstruct. It depends how many stars you have in there, what is the contrast ratio, and so forth, so on. But it's a bit above 10 in the best case, and always below 50 microarc seconds. So now you can ask yourself, well, what do you need? And here I find this plot from Cliff Will very instructive. You can see here the various effects illustrated as a function of the spin of the black hole. And you can see the Schwarzschild precession term. That's the one which we were talking before. That is rather easy if you think about here for an orbit which has only a month period or so. If you have a year orbit, then it's already more challenging. But our accuracy is on the level of 10 microarc seconds. The spin term is, of course, higher spins are easier to detect. And you can see that all the good curves, they all have very short period orbits of a month only. So I think it's more realistic to look at the one-year orbits. But you see that comes into, if you have a high spin, you have a chance of seeing that. The quadrupole moment, which would be in the next order, is even harder to do that. Of course, that experiment is not as clean as you think, because also there's Newtonian precession simply by the additional masses which are there. And David Merritt was estimating that, and it turns out that all the other stars which are around and which you will also have, they will perturb each other in somehow a chaotic way. And that leads in the end to signals which might mimic, of course, relativistic signals. And the only way to get that out is have a sufficient number of stars and observe sufficiently long. We don't know how many stars there will be. We think we have to simply try to do that. Also, Sagittarius stars, of course, of interest to us. You can see here how it looks in the infrared. That's that variable source here. You can see here raw data, and from time to time, Sagittarius star is flaring up, and it comes to a level of brightness that actually our interferometer should be able to see that. And you can make arguments that flare region is very small, and that it's probably close to the event horizon. And that means that it should orbit on the order of 60 to 100 microarc second or something like that. So that's something we can hope to astrometrically resolve. We will not get an image. The resolution of gravity is 3 or 4 milliarc seconds. But the astrometry should be good enough to distinguish between left and right in this image. Of course, this was realized early on, a historic movie from Avery here 10 years ago, where he calculated how a relativistic view of that orbiting hotspot would look like. And that's the signal, of course, we are after. So what data will we have? I'm rather simple-minded, so I think in very basic terms. And I think here's, for example, a light curve of a flare. That's a centroid track, which one might observe. And the basic quantities here are the period. You can sort of read off here, of course, also from the centroid track, you get the period. You do have the orbital size. And you also have somehow a magnitude here, which is related to the Doppler beaming. And you can convince yourself that there's a way to convert that into spin, radius, and inclination, which would be the basic parameters you need. We assume, of course, that we do know the mass of the black hole due to the stellar orbit measurements in that. And if you ask what is the difficulty of what we want to do, I think it's pretty easy. These beta square effects and radial velocity, we will get those. The relativistic progressive precession, it takes more time. It's a bit more challenging, but I also have very good hope for that. The next difficult step would be then to actually derive the spin from the flares. That's probably what is the next difficult experiment. Seeing the spin term in stellar orbits, that's the lens theorem precession, is even harder. And if you can come to the quadrupole moment of the metric, then you have tested, hopefully, the non-Hare theorem, simply by the fact that already the spin here tells you what the quadrupole moment needs to be in the next level. But of course, these steps are probably exponentially more difficult one after the other. Also, I can show that plot which has been shown here before. That's just comparing, adapted from Dimitrios' work as a function of mass here, the potential. You can see here the weak field test, and here is where our current orbits are. That is if we zoom in a factor 10. And if you go to the event horizon, we are essentially in the same regime as the Event Horizon Telescope. But as we've heard today, there's other tests which are here, for example, the gravitational wave or also the relativistic K alpha line. These are tests which go that far in the potential. So that is how it looks at our institute currently. People are heavily working on the instrument. That's what is inside. That's how gravity looks like. And that is when we close it, it's a cryogenic instrument in a cryostat. We hope that we will install at the VLT in 2015. The astrometry should be good to around 10 microarc seconds in 5 minutes. We'll be able to fringe track on the sources which we need in the galactic center. We will have adaptive optics available also. There's imaging capabilities. And we have a spectral resolution which can go up to 4,000. That depends, of course, on the brightness of the source you want to have a look at. So let me take, give me the last 5 minutes maybe to also comment on G2. Let's take the freedom to make a few comments here. You have seen the beautiful measurements Andrea has presented on Monday. So our main tool is position velocity diagrams, which we derive from our data cubes. And that is a relative recent advance from the last decade that you have images in the infrared where you have a full spectrum behind in each pixel. And the position velocity diagram you get by cutting through. So you have one position axis and the other axis is wavelength or, of course, velocity if you apply the Doppler formula. You're not restricted to cut in that way. We actually cut the cube in an optimum way to derive signals along an orbit. So we cut here along that curved trajectory in order to dig out what is the gas emission doing along the orbit. And I will show you now a movie. It's the worst movie ever you've seen. It contains 10 frames. It starts in 2004, and you can see here essentially the emission of G2 unresolved in both dimensions. The same is true in 2006. If you go to 2008, there's a bit of a change. You see now that this best-fitting ellipse somehow has rotated a bit. And if you wonder a second about it, you realize that's a not very healthy situation. The front part is moving at a higher velocity than the backside. That should never happen for a standard train. It means something is being sheared apart here. That's the interpretation. And that has beautifully evolved in 2010, 2011, 2012, 2013. And you can see that in 2013, in March, there's already a bit of gas appearing on the other side. That's a data set which is not very deep. The signal to noise here is too low. 2014, in April, a very deep data set. You can see roughly equal amounts of the gas. And in summer 2014, we have also gas here on both sides. Again, you see the noise level is high. It's not so deep, that data set. That evolution is essentially pretty much like what you would expect from a pure gas cloud of non-interacting particles. But we have, of course, a discrepancy here, and I try to be as sharp as I can. We have two views, probably taken within weeks from the object. On the left, you can see our bracket gamma map. So you can see the stars here overimposed as a background. And this is the red-shifted emission of G2. This is the blue-shifted emission of G2 in the spatial domain. And you can see it's close to pericenter, and that is resolved, at least in spectral imaging, it's resolved. And that we have to reconcile with the compact appearance in L-band. And I think I can only put a question mark here. Andrea has presented one of the models, but I think there's a real tension here. And I'm actually not sure that Andrea's model is able to reproduce that signature. I have not seen such a simulation which would do that. But it's early times maybe to ask that question. Also notice that in the position velocity diagram, there's following a tail, this G2 evolution. We can also dig out that tail here in image space. So there's gas following G2. There's just this single gas cloud which is getting sheared, but there's gas all along that orbit. And you can even look at this position velocity diagrams of the earlier years. I've blended out on purpose the blue shifted part of the diagram. If you blend that in, you can see that there's actually gas at that orbit. And if you look, it's moving along the orbit also. It's 2004, 2006, and 2008. And that emission we can also pick up in image space here from 2006 or 2008. Here's G2. Here's that object which we call G1 at the blue side. That's an old friend. And Andrea has also mentioned it. Here's a 2004 Keck image, an L-band from that. Also, we can pick it up here at later times, that VLT images showing the dust emission of that gas cloud. And the conclusion at the time was it's a nearby extended very red source, which we suggest arises from a locally heated dust feature. I subscribe to that statement. I don't know if Andrea still subscribes to her statement from that time. So having the astrometry, having the radial velocities, you can get an orbit. That's our standard business. You can see here we have NACO positions and we have symphony positions and radial velocities, of course, only from symphony. And what you get is that your orbit is actually relatively similar to the orbit of G2. Yeah. We have detected it along the orbit of G2. And you can see that these three angles are within 2 sigma or so the same. That means it's in the same plane, and the orientation of the ellipse is also in that plane identical. And we asked ourselves, well, maybe G1 is simply on the same orbit, but it experienced a drag force due to ramp pressure during precessor passage. And then you change your gravitational law, you include a ramp pressure term, and you advance the G1 data as if it would be G2 data in the future. And you ask if you can find an orbit that fits that. And the answer is yes, of course, you can find such an orbit. And let me try to combine all that here. So here's the co-addition of all position velocity diagrams of all years. You can see this is the G2 emission. There's a tail following. There's the post-pericenter gas, which has swung on the other side. And here's that emission of G1, which we have picked up. And I think it's a very viable hypothesis that G2 actually is just a knot in a much longer gas streamer. And let me finally comment on the firework issue. I answer to that in a very simple movie here. So imagine you are the supporter of the blue team. You know what will happen. And if you hear that situation in the radio, you're quite happy. But of course, you're much more happy if you're allowed to watch the scene. If you're allowed to see how that blue player will now score, you feel much better. And that's similar to our feeling when we see this tidal evolution. We know what will happen for a gas cloud falling to a black hole. It's easy to calculate, but still it's very nice. And sometimes it's actually worth to look, because not everything goes as expected. It's quite as expected. So maybe it takes a bit longer sometime until things come in. Thanks a lot for your attention.
Okay, thank you, Stefan. For the Americans, that's a sport called football. some questions for Stefan.
So Jeff, first, I think we call that soccer. Secondly, you added this ramp pressure term to evolve the orbit. What went into the assumption for the background gas? Is that just the background?
That was just the standard UAN 2003 model which was applied there. So there was
that's a RIAF or an ADAF.
That's an RIAF model. Yeah.
Okay.
But there was no wind in the model. You could play around a lot with it. We just used the most simple, the one which comes to your mind first, to show that you get a reasonable fit. We haven't really played the game of introducing extra parameters to make it fit, like wind or asymmetry or whatever. You could, of course, start to play those kind of games, sure.
Do you think that that's a way to verify the presence of a particular kind of accretion flow? Or do you think that's not going to be viable?
We have tried that, to leave the density parameter free. It's horribly unconstrained. No way.
Andrea?
About over-interpreting orbits before we have lots of orbital information. So at the moment, the Keck data is actually showing that you can, the angle of periaps is actually significantly different. So that's not
which
the picture,
is it?
Actually.
That one?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Oh, Demetrios?
To follow up on what Avery asked, there were some numerical simulations of clouds, like G2 kind of clouds running through an accretion flow. Did they show this amount of ramp pressure change in the orbit?
No. What you actually need is these clouds. They didn't include magnetic fields, and essentially the cloud gets enshrouded. What you need for that ramp pressure to work is you need to keep the cloud size more or less constant during pericenter passage. And that is something which you can expect if you include a magnetic field. There's work by the Berkeley team. Elliot, who is the first author, do you recall? So you need sort of a constant cloud size and the density from the Riot, then you can make it.
Like Sadovsky et al., they did it in full MHD simulation.
Yeah, but there was no magnetic field in that simulation. And that makes the cloud become too thin, and then it rushes through without any of that gram pressure interaction. So it's non-trivial to make it, I want to say.